done this before. Good morning. My name is Kenneth Thurman, and I'm the chair of the California Boating and Waterways Commission. Today, I'll be chairing the Boating and Waterways Commission meeting. I call to order the meeting of the May 5th, 2022 Commission meeting. This meeting is being held at the Four Points Sheraton Ventura Harbor Resort in Ventura, California, and virtually as well. As a reminder to everyone, this meeting is live and webcast and can be viewed at www.calspan.org. The archive video will also be available on the CalSPAN website. Before we get started with reports on today's agenda, let's please stand for the Pledge of Allegiance. Again, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, liberty, and justice for all. Next, I'd like to ask Megan Russell to take the role for the commission.
Present.
Vice Chair Hawkins of Truckee, California.
Present. Well, there we go. And Chair Ehrman of Oxnard, California.
Present.
Present. All commissioners present. Thank you.
Thank you, Megan. So now I'll ask Megan to read the opening statements regarding public comments on agenda and non-agenda items, and then other pertinent information regarding to our Zoom.
Yes, for those participating over Zoom today, if you are using a computer or tablet, please use the raised hand button in the Zoom webinar app, and we will unmute you, and we'll let you know when you are able to provide public comment. If you're calling in by phone, dial *9 to use the raise hand feature, and *6 to unmute your device. And each speaker will have 3 minutes. And I believe that's all that I have regarding Zoom today.
Thank you, Megan. Mm-hmm. So in order to provide comment on agenda items in person, members of the public are requested to fill out the green public comment form. And in order to provide comment on non-agenda items in person, members of the public are requested to fill out the blue public comment form. As Megan stated, each speaker will have 3 minutes to present their comments. Members of the public are not required to provide their names. However, stating it would make it easier for staff to contact them of members of the public for any follow-up if necessary. Individual speakers may not pull their comments under one person to obtain a longer comment period. Both public comment forms are available at the sign-in table. All completed forms should be turned into Megan Russell seated here at the commission table. If a speaker wishes to distribute documents to the commission, they must provide the required 4 copies and additional copies for public viewing. In future hearings, if documents are submitted by email to Megan Russell no later than 10 calendar days prior to the meeting, the copies will be included in the agenda packets provided to the commissioners on the day of the hearing. Our next agenda item is introduction of commission staff and local dignitaries. At this time, we will introduce the local dignitaries. We have Todd Mitchell, Business Operation Manager for Ventura Port District. We have John Higgins, Harbor Master, Ventura Port District. And Jessica Snippet, Business Operations Analyst from Ventura Port District. And if any of our dignitaries would like to address or speak this time, go ahead, please.
I was going to speak on an item. Should I speak on the item now or wait?
Well, wait for the item when it comes up on the agenda. Okay. So next we have introduction of State Parks and Department of Waterways staff. We have Liz McGurk, Chief Deputy Director, California State Parks. Do you wish to address?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, commissioners and members of the public and those watching us on Zoom. I'm really excited to be here this morning. This is actually my first in-person commission meeting since we went virtual during the pandemic. So I'm really happy to be here with everyone in person, and I'm looking forward to our meeting today, a really productive meeting, and looking forward to hearing from the public. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we have Ramona Fernandez, Acting Deputy Director, Boating and Waterways. And next, we have Karen Tobias, Legal Counsel for the Department of Parks and Recreations.
Turn these on. Oh, it's Catherine Tobias.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
Wrong glasses. Next agenda item, we have Chairman's Report, and I will save my discussion until we get to the activities. We'll move on. Next agenda item, Commissioner Activity Updates. So we will start with Commissioner Murillo. Any activities to update?
None at this time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Commissioner Peer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I did have just two items I wanted to report on. The first was I had the great pleasure and honor of attending Oceanology International Conference in London in mid-April. And for those unfamiliar with that conference, it is a very large gathering of really technological people who seek to address many of the issues that the world's oceans are facing. And it was a fantastic series of not only exhibitors with their various wares and autonomous ocean surveying equipment and robotic devices and so forth, but also a fantastic lecture series on many of the issues that are facing the oceans and the world's planet. It's not exactly under the purview of this commission, but I attended because I thought it important to understand the great hope that can be provided by some of the new technologies that most people I don't think are really familiar with. So it was a fascinating conference. And if I had to just sort of share my one takeaway with, there was a real concern among the attendees that we have really reached a turning point in the climate crisis that the world faces. And really the consensus of the various attendees was that this is frankly, as was repeatedly stated at the conference, an existential crisis. And this is not a manufactured problem, but rather something that humanity really needs to face and address. And their consensus was that the first thing that needs to be done is to really understand the scope of the problem and to accrue the necessary data to better appreciate how we can do the carbon, the effect of carbon emissions and so forth on the world's oceans. So I just wanted to share that. That was item number one. And then item number two, I'd just like to draw everyone's attention, because of course it's under the purview of this commission that we deal with beach erosion and remediation, and certainly in our working groups, that has been a tremendous focus of attention. And so I wanted to just bring to everyone's attention an article that appeared in the Chronicle, San Francisco Chronicle, on April 21. And it pertained to a community known as Gleason Beach, which is on the Sonoma coast in Northern California. And the article basically states the three strategies that the state of California undertakes to deal with beach erosion. One is retreat, accommodation, and protection. So protection is the what this commission, or rather the division, does in terms of beach replenishment and so forth. And the new strategy, apparently, of this experimental approach to the problem of beach erosion known as retreat, is to basically just take all of that funding and to move the community back 100 feet from the coastline. And so there's a, they're moving 21 homes. And basically there's just the strategy there, the retreat strategy, is to sort of throw up your hands and just say, we cannot possibly manage beach erosion in the way we have in the past. We're just going to move the community back. So they're moving Highway 1 in Sonoma, 21 homes. They're moving it all back another 100 feet because of the erosion. So I just wanted, I thought it pertinent to the, because we this division does spend so much resource in attempting to do protection strategies in beach erosion. And I thought that to be interesting and relevant. So again, that was April 21, San Francisco Chronicle, for those that are interested in reading more about the subject.
Thank you, Commissioner Peer. Vice Chair Hawkins.
Good morning, everyone. So from our, for my report, I just want to applaud the agency for delivering the final pathways on the 30 by 30 document. And as a coalition member on a state, on a statewide coalition, it's just amazing to see the partnership and collaboration that's happened with the public, diverse stakeholders, and the agency on this huge initiative. And so I look forward to continue to advance this work and excited to collaborate more with the, my fellow commissioners on this. In the Sierra Nevada, where I'm based, we received more snow in the month of April than we did January, February, and March. And so that's a priority for me because obviously we need the snowpack. And also that means that the snow is melting and people are coming to enjoy the Sierra Nevada now sooner than they probably would have in the past. So we're starting to see a lot of families, reservations are filling up at our state parks. And so we'll just see how the season goes. But we're, again, expecting, you know, year over year, we're seeing 100, 200% in reservations in our state parks right now up in the Sierra Nevada. So I'll keep the commission informed with our next meeting how everything is going. And then finally, our subcommittee that Commissioner Murillo and I are chairing together is the alternative funding meeting or committee subcommittee meeting. And we've had two meetings and we're developing a work plan with the staff so that we have some executable goals between now and the end of the year and recommendations that we could share back to leadership within the division. And so really nice to see the stakeholder engagement. Folks are coming to the table with a lot of ideas and energy on how we can advance some of these recommendations. And so I just, again, look forward to reporting that back to the commission at our next meeting. And that is my report.
Thank you, Vice Chair Hawkins. For myself, I'm very fortunate I get to live in this community. And we saw on the tour yesterday, it's very vibrant, the interaction with the water here. Harbor Master Higgins showed us the area where they launch, and the stand-up paddle boarding and the non-motorized boat use is just exploding in this area. And so when I tour around the state, when I go to different harbors, I like to see what the non-motorized boaters are doing. And I think it's probably the fastest portion of the water community that's growing right now. I remember when nobody did that. And the beauty of it is people who aren't traditionally water people or ocean people are finding their way out on paddle boards. And like they pointed out, Harbor Master Higgins pointed out, you can buy them for nothing and get in the water. So it's interesting. And I enjoy the way the facilities are morphing into that way in the future to make it more accessible. So it kind of dovetails into my subcommittee, but I try to look for the non-motorized users more. And I think it's interesting and exciting to see all these different people being brought to the water that wouldn't normally be there. So that's it for my activities. So move on, kind of dovetail on what Vice Chair Hawkins talked about. We'll go through the ad hoc committee reports, and I will start with Commissioner Peer. Any updates on your subcommittee?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So we had, I think we've had maybe four meetings of the subcommittee for program development, all of which I felt to be very productive and very well attended. And this is not a formal recommendation of our subcommittee, but to sort of tell you the ground that we have covered, which I thought was very certainly educational and informative to me. And also, I thought also helpful to the various stakeholders and staff, and with the great assistance of Karen, with the tremendous institutional knowledge that she has, being able to share that with us. So we met most recently on April 15th, 2022. And the real takeaways from our various meetings were, first, the importance of the sense from the stakeholders of the importance of really having a more formal analysis of the environmental, rather the economic impacts of boatings in California. And that was a major takeaway, that they felt that this had not been accomplished or not been undertaken in probably close to a decade, and that there was a lot of sort of information that needed to be shared with legislators and so forth on the benefits of the boating community and to the general economy of California. That was the first. Second, as I've alluded to in my prior comments, the sense that sort of boating and waterways is being unfairly burdened with beach replenishment programs and restoration. And we had some great background. Many thanks, of course, to Ms. Dill, about understanding the historical origins of that and the building out of marinas, as we discussed yesterday on our various tours. Thirdly, we dove into the invasive species. And again, this burden, sort of the financial burden that's placed on the boating community, primarily in the Delta, about, you know, how much of a financial burden that has become on the boating community, and some sense that that is perhaps unfairly burdened by boaters, whereas there are other stakeholders such as water, you know, water districts, shipping interests, agricultural interests, and so forth, and that there might be a sense that we could sort of do some burden shifting there to free up some of the resources that boating and waterways might otherwise use. We also dove into, and I thought that the presentations yesterday on this surrendered and abandoned vessels were quite informative, and that the consensus of my subcommittee was that we might want to sort of look more proactively at looking at more proactive rather than retrospective means of addressing issues. And as you know, as the attendees yesterday know, that was a real focus of certainly here in Ventura County, that they are really working with local people about getting vessels surrendered before they are abandoned. And that's a much more cost efficient way of addressing the issue. And I think that's about as far as we got. I think we still have a lot of some ground to go through. And I think we're meeting in another month or something like that to just kind of keep plowing through these various programs and understanding what the various stakeholders have to offer. And so that's my report.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner Peer. Commissioner Murillo, anything to add from your subcommittee meetings?
I think the committee chair wrapped it up very well.
Vice Chair Hawkins.
No, I apologize. I did. Okay.
You want me to keep talking some more?
So I chair the subcommittee on on revenue generating, alternative revenues, and Joanna Drotti sits on that committee with me. And I think what is interesting, the stakeholders kind of took a while to get going. We kind of all had different ideas about who should be paying more and who shouldn't. And so once we kind of got all on the same page, we started looking at what other states are doing, especially Oregon, about how they're adding fees to non-motorized boating usage, and different structures like that. I think we kind of are starting to get on a consensus and going in the same direction. So I think that these working groups, they're extremely productive. I think for most of the attendees and the stakeholders, everyone brings their own expertise to the table, and we're able to kind of all share information. So I think going forward, they're extremely productive. And I think, if nothing else, a lot of us commissioners have learned a lot more about the environment we're working in on the Boating and Waterways Commission. So we have our next meeting on May 25th. We typically meet for about an hour in the middle of the day, because that's when the most of us can find a time that works for all of us. But we try to cover at least one or two definitive topics in each meeting. And it's a long process, but I think we're making good progress in terms of non-motorized boating, possibly the possibility of additional fees that will be generated by them. And so I think we're building consensus. Again, from the beginning, nobody wanted to pay anything for anything. So now I think we're heading in the direction that we can either find a happy medium, or at some point there's just going to be a deficit. So I look forward to the work we have going ahead of us, but I think they're very productive. And that is all I have for that. So I want to just thank all the commissioners for all the time and dedication they put to both the commission meetings and the subcommittees, and their commitment to these projects going forward. Next agenda item, we have the Deputy Director's Report, and Acting Deputy Director Ramona Fernandez will present on the division updates.
There should be a PowerPoint. So good morning, Commission. It is good to see everyone in person, and I think we had a great tour yesterday, so I hope that you guys took away from that tour that we had. And so I will go ahead and begin my update from the division. Next slide, please. So as with every commission meeting, I'll do it kind of an administrative update of what the division, where we are in terms of administrative and some program updates. So first, we do have some new staff that joined us. Timothy Giles is a new park and rec specialist as a grant administrator in our quagga and zebra mussel infestation prevention grant program. We also continue, as I've reported in prior commission meetings, been challenged with continuous recruitment. So we have been able to get the aquatic pest control technician classification on a continuous exam basis. So this is big for us, because we'll be able to recruit from that pool of candidates continuously as we have the need. Next slide, please. This time of year is pretty busy for our administrative unit, along with, you know, our program delivery and everything that, all the other things that are going on within the division. Our admin team is busy with what we call year end, prior to the end of this fiscal year and to start of the new one. And so they've been closing out year-end expenditures, also trying to meet deadlines to get procurement and contract services in place. And so some of the examples of those include some safety items, spraying equipment, herbicides, tools, just large purchases. So Maria Perez and her team have been really busy with trying to get us on track with our year-end. Next slide, please. So this is one of the things that I've been reporting to the commission on as we meet. And so just our numbers with our vessel registration and where we are. This number that you see is significantly low in comparison to the last report. It's about almost 165,000 difference. So what we have found in working with the DMV, that it, as many of you may realize, that the registration is on a cycle. So in looking at, you know, this time of year, last year, it could mean that this is kind of a trend. So we continue to watch and monitor these numbers, because obviously we know that this impacts the fund with registration and with all the discussions going on in the various ad hoc committees. And also, I'll start reporting on our documented vessels. So as many of you are aware, that boaters can register either through the state
registration process or through the federal on the as a documented vessel. And we work with the U.S. Coast Guard to get these numbers. And as of this date, there's about 30,000 documented vessels in California that are recreational. And there's about 1,559 of the commercial vessels. Next slide, please.
I'm sorry, how many commercial?
Commercial, there's 1,559. So this slide is, again, just, I presented this prior, the last commission meeting in February. So this is just budget highlights from the Budget Act. These are, as you noted up there, it's just our, it shows what's in the budget for the proposed budget. And as you can see, it's the 30 million continuous from the general fund to support our programs as we work through, you know, solvency on the fund, and as well as the funds for the public beach restoration in the general fund. This time of year also is May revise, so we anticipate that coming out within this next week or so. Next slide, please. This again is just kind of a recap to you to show the funding levels and support our support dollars and our local assistant dollars that are proposed in the budget. And next slide, please. And again, this shows our, this captures our proposed program support budget for each of our programs for next fiscal year. Next slide, please. And I'm gonna go on to a little, some updates on the grants and loans program. And so as I mentioned before, and I think was mentioned yesterday at the tour, our layout design and construction handbook for the small craft boat launching facilities is now complete and it is available on our website. We have a couple new staffing project managers in our grants unit, Nicole, who you'll hear from in a bit, and also Ethan Trattner, who is now taking over the boating infrastructure grants and our CVA, our Clean Vessel Act grants. We have completed 4 boating facility projects over these past few months. Marina Del Rey, which was a planning grant, the Lower Blue Oaks, the Dom Pedro Lake, which was also a planning grant, the Henderson Open Space Non-Motorized Boat Launch Facility, which was a construction, and that was in Redding. And Lake Merced, also a non-motorized, was in San Francisco, and that was also a construction grant. New projects that were getting started. Isleton Boat Launch Facility is planning. Rock Creek Lake, construction. Hoodman Slough Fishing Access, which is a construction project. Oceanside Jolly Roger Dock, which was a boating infrastructure grant. And the City of Redondo Beach Pump Out Dock. We have 11 accessible floating restrooms that are currently being manufactured. And we also have 18 Aquatic Center grantees that will be hosting in person National Safe Boating Week events. And I'll talk a little bit about National Safe Boating Week in the next few slides. The upcoming application process, we've received 7 boat launch facility grants, 5 floating restroom applications, 3 Clean Vessel Act pump out applications, and 30 boating safety and enforcement grants. Or applications, sorry, 26 of the surrendered and abandoned vessel applications. So those are currently in the review process now. Next slide, please. And in our Quagga Zebra and Mussel grant program, April 15th, the grant program period closed for this next grant cycle. We received 10 applications with approximately 3.2 requests. And it's up on the screen. We'll be making awards for those grants over this as summer, as indicated on the screen. Next slide, please. That is the grants Quagga Zebra contact information. And next slide, please. Our aquatic invasive plant control program. As you can see on the screen, we started the treatment March 17th. We will end, and this is for herbicide treatment, November 30th of 2022. The team continues to focus on the mission to support economy, environment, and public health. Both the submersed and the floating programs have started to focus treatments on boating accessibility over the past year due to the anticipated and have also focused on the Southern Delta this year due to the anticipated warmer temperatures and the increasing of the invasive plant growth. And also with the fish restoration program sites, we continue to be treated in collaboration with the Department of Water Resources, and that's through a contract with that department. Next slide, please. This slide just indicates where we've been treating and how much acreage we've treated for the submersed. And the next slide, please, shows our floating efforts. Next slide, please. Okay, our California Boater Card program, as indicated on the screen, we've received over 166,000 applications and issued 132,000 cards. The difference there is either boaters will start our process but don't have meet the criteria for the boater education. So we aren't able to issue that card yet until they can show that they've completed that education portion. That's kind of the difference there. We're in our fifth year of implementation, which means 45 years and younger need to have a card. All of our exemptions can be found on californiaboatercard.com. Let's see what else. The next slide, please. Okay. Boating safety outreach. So we are approaching a National Safe Boating Week that begins on May 20th, and May 21st runs through May 27th, starts the National Safe Boating Week effort. And we are slowly starting to anticipate participating in in-person events. As many of you are aware, during COVID, we switched our focus from our already established online platforms to more digital engagements. And through that effort, we have found that it does benefit to have the online strategy because we have been able to reach a larger number of people than in-person events. We also found that we can geo-target our audience to ensure that we're reaching boaters in the most crucial locations. National Safe Boating Week, we'll also be introducing a new contents and digital content each day on safe, clean, and green boating. We'll be partnering with the U.S. Coast Guard on Friday, May 20th, and that'll be a Facebook Live event, and it'll virtually kick off National Safe Boating Week. We'll also be hosting a Wear Your Life Jacket to Work Day on Friday, May 20th. And we'll be having daily boating safety tips posted on our social media threads. We've created original and engaging content on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and that has received over 54 million impressions and over 119,000 website clicks. Next slide, please. As many of you are aware, life jackets are used as an educational tool to promote safe boating, and this gives us the opportunity to teach proper fit and use of life jackets. Last year, we distributed over 6,000 life jackets to boaters. We partnered with over 24 local marine law enforcement agencies to provide life jackets for educational use. And these partners are also mutually benefit for positive outreach and education on safe boating and water education. We currently have over 100 life jacket loaner stations now in the state. We also have a new component to the life jacket loaner program, which is available for anyone to get a loan station kits that will include all material needed to assemble a standalone loaner board, such as lumber, hardware, and signage. These kits are available to order through our fulfillment contractor. Another new addition to the program is a double-sided signage this year that will include an English and Spanish side. Additionally, in 2022, we've added 5 new life jacket loaner stations, which include Lake Paris State Recreation Area, the city of Lodi, and South Yuba River SRA State Recreation Area. Next slide, please. So in accordance with Section 51879.7 of the California Education Code, the Division of Boating and Waterways is responsible to provide fundamental water safety and training for all children of the state so that California's youth will be able to enjoy water recreation while avoiding its hazards. DBW provides this, the AquaSmart program and other youth outreach to fulfill this requirement. The AquaSmart live puppet and game shows have traditionally been performed in person at schools within the high boating accident targeted areas. Due to COVID, many schools remained virtual throughout the 2021 school year, and the AquaSmart live shows were presented virtually with upgraded digital enhancements, including animation and a new introduction to the program. Schools were contacted through an online email blast utilizing the California Department of Education school lists. The AquaSmart shows continue to be successful on this virtual platform, with 242 school performances reaching about 100,000 students. New in the spring of 2021, the virtual show was translated into Spanish and made available to schools. This new Spanish version was requested by over 30 schools, and the AquaSmart Live show reached an estimated 87,000 California students. In the 2021-2020 school year, the AquaSmart Live presented at 242 sites and reached approximately 150,000 students. Next slide, please. So in coordination with our marketing and communications division, the goal of the division's statewide marketing campaign is to educate people about the safe boating practices, primarily the importance of wearing a life jacket while out on the water. We target messages mainly to power boaters, but also rotate in messaging and creative that would speak to paddlers, kayakers, stand-up paddlers, as well as anglers and fishermen. The campaign targets the top 5 boating accident targeted areas, as reported in the division's annual boating safety report. These areas this year include the Los Angeles Riverside, Sacramento, San Diego, San Francisco, and the Stockton-Modesto areas. This year, we are also targeting Fresno as it hit harder. There was a harder hit on accidents than the previous years. We plan to launch the campaign to coincide with National Safe Boating Week, which again will start May 20th to May 27th, and the start of our boating season, and it will run through Labor Day. The media includes early morning TV, digital, radio, highway billboards adjacent to waterways, transit shelters in San Diego, and year-round social media promoted posts. We also have hanging posters at over 225 marinas, which I think you all kind of saw at the marinas here in this area. The campaign is also supported by a website, boatcalifornia.com, and an app with boating information and social media channels. Next slide, please. This slide is one of our highway billboards from last year's campaign, and we are still in the development stage of our creative for this next year, which will be similar, but we'll be updating images. And next slide, please. As you notice, this one, we wanted to kind of recognize one of our commissioners.
No.
And next slide, please.
Thank you for that. I appreciate it.
And that concludes my report. Mr. Chair, I do have a legislative update. If there isn't any questions on my report.
Do any commissioners have questions on the report?
Mr. Chair, may I?
Yes, please.
As you know, I always have questions. So that's a pretty striking drop in vessel registration. I mean, I think my notes indicated that there was 700,000 and now we're down to 538 and change. So what, I mean, that's first of all, it's a lot of dough. And secondly, that just seems completely aberrant. Right. In terms of what you might expect. So what, I mean, how do we account for that?
So what we're doing is looking, I mean, again, as mentioned, we kind of looked at the trend from last year because it's on a, the registration site, it's on a cycle for DMV. So it could be through the transit and process on their end of the registration. So we're working with DMV on those numbers. So yeah, we do believe that it isn't, really what we truly have, you know, okay. in terms
so
of
it's
the real,
it's more of a reporting issue
right.
than actual
looking at that because it has it declined for several years. We did bring our numbers up a bit, you know, through COVID, obviously our numbers went up. So we're watching that trend just to make sure that it's not, but we it's too significant that there's that big of a drop.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I would think that I guess we have a net population decrease in the state, but I mean, I think we had a lot of conversations in these commission meetings about sort of increased boating usage. So I would think that it would be driving the numbers the other direction.
Right.
But it sounds like that's mostly a reporting issue.
Right.
My second question is on the zebra mussel grants, and this is, and I appreciate everyone indulging me in my many questions. So I'm not, so 3.2 million in grants. Mm-hmm. So what are those, is that remediation? What are the grants for? What does that go to?
The grants go to a prevention program.
It's so prevention. Okay. That's yes. what I wanted yes. to know. Okay, good. And then thirdly, so the, if we look at the boater card applicants, 166,000 versus number of registered vessels, we're kind of at a quarter of where we right. need to be.
Yes.
So how is that? Well, I mean, I guess you have elderly people who have boats, so that's, they have grandfathered and all that sort of age criteria that you've established. But how is that trending, I guess, is my question.
So that program is one of the ones that we are definitely this year looking at to see where we need to maybe change or where can we improve and look at the program itself. Because, yes, yeah. we are also looking at those numbers of the number of cards that we've issued. We are at the 45 and younger age. So we're, you know, over this next year, I think it's going to be 50. And then, of course, the 55 and then it's everyone else. So, we're definitely reevaluating the program, how our outreach, working closer with perhaps law enforcement on how they're messaging or citing or, you know, getting some more statistics so we can look at that program.
I would imagine, you know, being a member of this commission, I'm aware of the program, but I would think the average voter just simply is not aware that this is like a requirement for them. So I would commend you to continue your outreach and then just looking at sort of the, I mean, I am one, and I don't know if Ken, you ever finished your application and got your voter's card, but I'm one of the, let's see, I'm one of the 130,000 people who applied, but never ended up finishing the program. Okay. So, but that's my own shortcoming. But I want to point out, because we're here to represent the public, yes, that we're really at 32,000 for a vessel registration of 450,000, which is not a tremendously, that's a 1 in 10 compliance rate. Yep. Right. So I'll just make that point and then I'll stop talking right now. Thank you.
Any other commissioner comments or questions?
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chairman, there was a meeting at, in Torrey Pines, and the commission, or maybe one of our subcommittees, met at Torrey Pines several months ago, and it was in concert with kind of an addendum to a boating association conference, if you'll recall, Ramona. Could we decide one way or the other? Could we get a staff recommendation? Who's going to manage the registration, DMV or us?
So currently, as you all know, the Department of Motor Vehicles handles registration for us. Part of the, I think, ad hoc committee discussions, as I understand, and it's probably in Mr. Chair's commission, ad hoc committee, there has been discussion. So this is... there has been discussions of that transition, but as of now, the Department of Motor Vehicles is handling registration, voter registration.
As of now, does this mean that?
Yeah, well, it's currently in. So it's, it's in statute of them to the Department of DMV to manage our registration. So we, you know, in unless something changes in legislation, we'll continue how we are have it now.
And the pros and cons seem to weigh in favor of DMV.
And that is, again, discussions on ad hoc. So the whole purpose of those ad hoc committees and us engaging with the boating community, I think once we have the data in each of those committees work and review proposals during that time, then we'll look at the proposed recommendation.
If I can just comment, one of the things we're dealing with too is the boat and the trailer are two different animals altogether. Trailer being essentially a vehicle and the boat being not. It's really difficult to take one thing that's not really in the purview of boating and waterways and put it into their jurisdiction to register. So that's one of the issues we're having as well. Any other questions or comments, Vice Chair? So I just want to commend the voter safety message is so vital right now, because what we're seeing is the participatory population is exploding, and so some of the waters are shrinking so vastly that we go to, like, when I go to Bass Lake, it's like a freeway there on the water, and there's all the law enforcement agencies are short staffed. There's one boat out there and he's managing like a massive thoroughfare, and the boaters who are operating safely stand out completely from the individuals who have no idea what they're doing. And they're not properly prepared, and we see accidents and people are getting run over. And so the boating safety messages is so vital, and to provide it to the underserved communities, unrepresented, there's plenty of people in California who don't aren't fluent in English, but operate in these communities. And so the message being translated in different languages over different mediums really makes a big difference. So I really applaud that effort. It said before, it'd be so easy during the pandemic to just stop, like so many industries did, just said, it's COVID, we're not going to do anything anymore. But we were kind of, you guys already kind of had it in place. So to transition digitally was almost seamlessly. So I think it's a much bigger effort than what people realize.
I will just add something. One of the initiatives that was adopted at the pandemic was the Recreate Responsibly campaign, which California and Parks has adopted. And this focus for this year is Recreate Responsibly on the Water. So this is a campaign that is viral, has a ton of national support. So I think in conjunction with what we're doing here and that campaign, we'll be able to the chair's point, be able to reach more folks and educate them, because that is the mission of our work here, is to make sure that people have a safe and equitable experience on the water. So I feel like we have a good foundation, and there's just more energy around this coming. So that's promising.
Please continue.
Thank you. So I'll now do the legislative update provided by our legislative division under the direction of Maribel Barajas, who's our deputy director. Summary, this report provides a summary excerpt and status of legislation affecting the Division of Boating and Waterways. Information contained in this report is accurate as of May 2nd, 2022. California legislation update, Assembly Bill 1682, Public Safety, Speeding Vessels, Lifeguard Rescue Vessels. Summary, this bill will clarify that lifeguard rescue and law enforcement vessels are exempt from the 5 mile an hour speed limit identified for specific areas in the Harbors and Navigation Code 655.2, which includes within 100 feet of a person bathing or water skiing, within 200 feet of a beach, swimming, float, or diving platforms. The status, it passed to the Senate. Assembly Bill 2346, Outdoor Recreation Equitable Access Grant Program. Summary, this bill will establish the Equitable Access Grant Program to be administered by the Natural Resources Agency to provide financial and technical assistance to local agencies and nonprofit organizations to implement community access projects to expand access and stewardship of outdoor recreation areas throughout the state. Status, it was referred to Assembly Appropriations Committee. Senate Bill 1065, California Abandoned and Derelict Commercial Vessel Program. Summary, this bill will establish the California Abandoned and Derelict Commercial Vessel Program within the Natural Resource Agency to be administered by the State Lands Commission, and would establish the Abandoned and Derelict Commercial Vessel Program Trust Fund. The bill will require the State Lands Commission to create an inventory of abandoned and derelict commercial vessels in waters of the state, and to establish an abandoned and derelict commercial vessel plan to provide framework to facilitate and track actions that prevent or reduce the number of abandoned vessel and derelict commercial vessels on the waters of the state as specified. The bill would also establish the California Abandoned Derelict Commercial Vessel Program Coordinating Council within agency to oversee the program, coordinate the removal of derelict commercial vessels, identify all costs associated with vessel removal, evaluate the program and challenges, and make recommendations to the legislature. The status is referred to Senate Appropriations Committee. This is information I'm sharing is information only for the commission. That completes my report. Thank you.
Any comments on the pending legislation from commissioners?
I will. I would just to highlight the Assembly Bill 2346, the Outdoor Recreation Equitable Access Grant Program. This is an amazing piece of legislation that really helps support getting Californians to the outdoors and eliminating the barriers and resources to do that. It's, again, with grants and grants. Usually these go towards capital improvements, infrastructure. This is actually helping with programming, education, transportation, and again, eliminating those barriers to be able to connect more Californians to nature. And I'll say some of the partners that I've worked with is a great organization down in the San Diego region, which brings youth to the beach. And I would just strongly support this.
Thank you. Any other comments?
As always, Senate Bill 1065, commercial vessels. So that's would be similar, obviously, to the so-called SAFE program that this department administers. Is that a division, I should say? Is that correct?
I don't think that the details have been identified in that bill yet of how it would be administered.
Okay. And so then my question is, waters of the state. I mean, that's always seems to be the bugaboo that transfixes me and I obsess over. So, I mean, obviously, most commercial vessels operate in ocean waters, offshore waters. And so I guess the first question is what does it mean as waters of the state as specified? So that's, I think that's the phrase that you use. And I'm trying to understand what that might mean. If I'm a crab fisherman operating out of San Francisco Bay and I'm running up and down the coast, I'm obviously operating in federal waters. Why is, I mean, I appreciate that the state is wants to undertake this as part of a trust fund, but it's kind of not, shouldn't, I don't know, I shouldn't be pejorative or judgmental, but it seems to me some of that shouldn't be on our dime, although maybe at the end of the day, we're sort of stuck with it regardless. But so do you have, maybe you can just, do you have any, what does that mean, waters of the state as specified? Good. This is what I was driving at. I wanted Karen to get up and.
Thank you, Karen Dill, Chief of Grants and Loans. I've been privileged to be a part of the working group on behalf of the agency and representing the division and the department in this effort, along with the other departments within the agency that deal with this issue. Waters of the state would typically, if a commercial vessel is abandoned, it will end up on our shores. And so State Lands Commission is responsible for the majority of properties within our shorelines, both on lakes, rivers, and the ocean. So it would be any state lands, the state parks owns it, it would be state that would can be considered state lands as well. So it would cover pretty much the entire, well, everything within the state, except for small ponds that would be privately owned.
Yeah. So I guess this loops back to the conversations we had, extensive conversations we had yesterday about trying to be proactive about abandoned vessels, right? Before they end up on the shore or the beach or, you know, in the Delta, wherever the heck it is. Right. And so, So I understand what you're saying about state lands ending up sort of being the responsible party when the boat ends up on the beach. But I'm wondering how this, in my working group, there was a real sense that getting ahead of the curve on these abandoned vessels is really the way to proceed. And so I don't know if this SB 1065 is trying to take that tact, I suppose, but it sounds like this is at a very early stage. So maybe my questions are a little misplaced, or perhaps maybe we don't have the information at this juncture.
Correct. It's very preliminary at the moment. This legislation as proposed currently would establish a working group, advisory committee of all the different agencies. And part of the discussion has been that advisory committee would not only address when a vessel is abandoned, but also that proactive stance of how do we let people know that if they abandon a vessel, that there are repercussions for that.
Yeah.
Again, it's preliminary, and the advisory committee would take the primary responsibility for addressing both the proactive as well as the reactive responses.
So you said all of the agencies involved. So who would that be? State lands? Oh, and
I don't. So state lands, of course, parks.
That's but too fine a point.
CalRecycle would be part of it.
Okay.
And it's noted in the legislation. I don't have that at the tip of my.
Great. Not Division of Boating and Waterways, I imagine.
Well, we're part of parks. So it would be the director and his whoever he assigns.
Right. All right. Thank you.
Okay. Any other commissioner comments? So we'll move on to our next agenda item, facility grant presentations. And at this time, we'll have Nicole Inlet with Ventura Harbor Boat Launch Facility presenting.
Good morning, Chairman Ehrman, Commissioners, Chief Deputy Director McGurk, Acting Deputy Director Fernandez, and Legal Counsel Tobias. My name is Nicole Inglot, Project Manager with the Grants and Loans Unit. I'm presenting the Ventura Port District's request for an $890,000 planning and construction grant for improvements to the Ventura Harbor Boat Launching Facility. Representing the Ventura Port District is the Business Operations Manager, Todd Mitchell. We are seeking the Commission's advice and comment on this proposed project. My remote is not working. Okay. Boating and Waterways Commission members completed an official visit to the proposed boat launching facility site yesterday, May 4th, 2022, as part of the commission tour. Ventura Harbor BLF is located within the Ventura Harbor, approximately 60 miles northwest of Los Angeles, California. The harbor, including the BLF, is owned and operated by Ventura Port District and features 1,600 berths, a boat launching facility, charter fishing operations, commercial fishing support facilities, a harbor patrol, two boat repair yards, fuel docks, public restrooms, hotels, restaurants, and a seaport village with shops. Ventura Harbor BLF is open to the public, provides ocean access, and does not charge to launch vessels, but has a $10 per day maximum parking fee in the main parking area. There is no fee to park in the overflow lot, which I'll show on the next slide. The BLF is open year-round with its peak season between March and November. The busiest weekdays for recreational boating are Thursday through Sunday, and for commercial and research boating is Monday through Wednesday. Ventura Harbor is used by motorized and non-motorized boaters for stand-up paddleboarding, kayaking, sailing, water sports, and more. Ventura Harbor BLF features a 6-lane boat launch ramp, which is down here. With two 180-foot pile-guided boarding floats, a boat washdown area, a restroom, main parking area for a variety of vehicle trailer, single vehicle, and ADA parking, as well as an overflow lot to the east of the boat launch ramp at the corner of Harbor Boulevard and Schooner Drive, which is over here. Continued improvements to the facility as proposed in this project will improve safety and accessibility at the BLF and will keep the facility usable for 20 years to come for both locals and tourists. The existing boat ramp is in good condition with V-grooves intact for adequate traction for launching and retrieval of boats. Ventura Port District received a grant from the Division of Boating and Waterways, Harbors and Watercraft Revolving Fund in 2013 for the reconstruction of the concrete boat launch ramp at the Ventura Harbor BLF. The previous grant did not include replacement of the boarding floats, as they had approximately 10 years of service life remaining. The district has maintained the boarding floats in the years since the ramp reconstruction. However, the float hardware has rusted and weakened, as you can see on the slide. causing two floats to break away during recent high wave events. The floats have been reattached, but the district anticipates that the condition will continue to deteriorate and pose safety risks until the floats can be replaced. The wooden deck boards are also deteriorating and have undergone continuous repair. The boarding floats currently are serviceable, but deteriorating rapidly. The piles were replaced in the previous grant and remain in good condition. The new floats will be attached to the existing abutments and guide piles. The boat washdown station is located on a concrete island. This raised island is surrounded by a concrete curb, as I'm pointing there, which is not accessible for those with disabilities. DBW funded the replacement of the parking area in the previous grant, and Ventura Port District has recently completed needed maintenance that includes replacing the drain covers at the boat washdown area, resurfacing and restriping the parking lot, and slurry sealing the asphalt concrete vertical curve at the top of the ramp, which has experienced pitting and wear from the saltwater exposure. This facility includes a 6-unit restroom, which is in decent condition and will not be replaced or improved under this proposed grant. The project credit sign was installed in 2014 and therefore does not need to be replaced. The proposed improvements will include installing 2 new 8-foot-wide by 180-foot-long boarding floats and utilizing the existing abutments and guide piles. The proposed improvements will also include removing the raised island and curb to provide ADA accessibility at the washdown area. It will also replace the concrete drainage pads and protective bollards. The district is going to purchase a new boat wash station, which the grant will install. Only preliminary planning and concept designs for the boat washdown have been completed. This table identifies the estimated costs of proposed improvements. The entire project cost as proposed is $890,000. This estimate includes a construction contingency fund reserved for any unforeseen overages that may occur during the construction process. The estimate also includes an escalation of 26.8%, which is based on last year's construction cost index of 13.4%. We estimate that 33,240 motorized and non-motorized boaters will benefit from these improvements annually, and 664,800 boaters will benefit from the improvements over the 20-year life of this grant. DBW analysis establishes that a benefit-cost ratio exceeding 1 is worthy of consideration from a financial perspective. The benefit-cost ratio for this proposed project is 1.46. As a condition of the grant, the district shall complete the California Environmental Quality Act, or CEQA, requirements at its own expense. No reimbursement will occur until CEQA is complete. The district will be responsible for operating and maintaining the BLF improvements for 20 years after construction completion. At this time, DBW seeks advice and comment on this proposed $890,000 Harbors and Watercraft Revolving Fund construction grant to the Ventura Port District for the Ventura Harbor Boat Launching Facility Improvements as described in this May 5th, 2022 feasibility report. This concludes my presentation. My contact information is provided on the screen. Todd Mitchell with the Ventura Port District and I will be available to answer your questions. Thank you.
So at this time, we have Todd Mitchell. Public comment?
Yes. Thank you all. Trying to drown you out. In addition to the district staff, I'm also pleased to share that the chairman of the Ventura Port District's Board of Commissioners is here. So thank you, Chairman Stevens. On behalf of the Ventura Port District, I'd like to offer our sincere appreciation for the division's consideration of our grant application. In particular, I'd like to thank staff for their support and for arranging the site visit. And our tenants appreciate your patronage here at the hotel and at the restaurants. So thank you for that as well. I can affirm that the Ventura Port District can efficiently complete the project, and we look forward to continuing to improve the public boating experience for the residents and visitors to Ventura Harbor. In addition to appreciating the support of the commission on this item, I generally like to thank the division for all of the programs that you offer that make available that benefit boaters for Ventura County and throughout the state. We greatly appreciate the partnership on this and other programs. So thank you very much for your consideration of the project. And of course, we're happy to answer any questions. The Harbor Master here as well is very experienced and actually is the day-to-day manager of the facility. Thank you.
Do we have anybody on Zoom?
Any member of the public on Zoom would like to speak on this item, please raise your hand. Chair Ehrman, we have no raised hands on Zoom.
Did we have any questions or comments from commissioners? Go ahead, sir.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Nicole, first of all, I regret not being here for the tour yesterday. It would have been very beneficial, but it was impossible for me to make it out here. And this was probably answered. What's the duration of this kind of a project, or this one in particular, from start to finish? And I'm assuming there's no major disruption in services during that period.
Sure. So we estimate about 2 years for completion of this project. Obtaining any permits can take up to a year. The district said on the tour yesterday that they don't anticipate any issues with CEQA as it is a replacement of an existing project. So that's more just a formality to file the documentation before we can reimburse any expenses. So most of that time is permitting, but once we have all that settled, the installation, we'll do design and engineering, but the district has already, sought consultation for some of those items, just preliminary estimates. And so they have, a good idea of which manufacturers they might want to seek out. So it should be a pretty smooth process.
And during the couple, there shouldn't be any significant closures or?
I might defer to Todd on this one.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'll say that, and perhaps being aggressive, it's our intent to complete the project within a year. We should be able to get a categorical exemption as well as a waiver from the Coastal Commission for CDP. But the anticipation is to phase the program so that we remove one dock so that there's only disruption of one side at a time, and also to do that out of season so that we're minimizing the impact. According to the manufacturer, that the construction will take place largely off-site, so there won't be a lot of work in the area consuming the parking spaces. So we anticipate minimal disruption.
Well, that's good to know. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other commissioner comments, questions?
I would just ask, Todd, I'm sorry, I forget your last name, but yesterday we spoke about those pilings.
Yes.
And that they're not going to be replaced. And
correct.
Were they to be, that might trigger other, environmental CEQA.
Absolutely.
Process and so forth. So I guess my question is, were those replaced in 2013 and the past grant?
Yes. So.
Okay.
It was actually very wise to have done it at the time. At the time, we implemented an ordinance for all piles within the harbor to be 15 feet above mean sea level. That's to account for the sea level changes. We had a study done, I believe it was in 2012, to ascertain the correct height that we should be doing. We will be doing an update to the study, but the four tsunamis we've experienced indicate that we're probably at the right height for the foreseeable future. But yes. Had we disturbed the sea bottom to put in new piles now, then we would be going through CEQA, we would be going through CDP, we would be getting permission from the Corps of Engineers, and the Regional Water Quality Board. So that step being completed significantly reduces the level of effort at this time.
So I guess my question is just, so what's the anticipated lifespan? Not to put too fine a point on it, but I mean, we just kind of kicking the can down the road here, and you're going to be here in another 10 years saying, well, we got to replace those pilings now. Or what's let me just ask the question this way. Yeah. What's the anticipated lifespan of the existing pilings?
Well, the study that was done in 2012 anticipated the pile height should be suitable for the sea level projections of 2100.
Setting that aside.
For 100 years. So at this point, you know, we're seeing more aggressive sea level change, you know, globally, although locally it's not crazy, but I think episodic events, we're seeing more episodic events. So it's hard to say. I would anticipate we're going to be at least 30 years.
Beyond
the service life of the dock.
I understand. Yeah. So setting aside sea level change, which I understand.
Yeah.
I mean, anything in the water is going to corrode. So what, I mean, those things have been in the water for 10 years now. So any sense of?
Generally a concrete pile like that should have a 50 or 75 year service life.
Oh, is that right? Okay, yeah. Great. Thank you. Yeah, I had nothing further. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I just quick question.
Wait a second. I think the project credit sign is out of date, and I would commend very highly that staff revisit that, because it looks like it's deteriorating and we might want to update some of the information on it. Okay, that's all.
Happy to look at that.
My question, I apologize if you covered this yesterday. When they do the ADA compliance on the boat wash, how long would that be down for?
I don't know if I have an exact time frame. I mean, the largest component of that is really the concrete work. So if we've procured all of the assets in advance, recent concrete work we've done in the village side, the shopping center, you know, the forms and curbs, probably maybe 3 weeks to, you know, it's really about getting the forms just perfectly right. Then when we're done, we have to make sure that the forms are CASP inspected, meaning that they're ADA approved. After the concrete's poured, you have to go back. You may have to grind and such like that. But we really want to make sure that we get it right, so that we took that off of our list. ADA projects have been a very important thing for us to address over the last few years, and we have numerous on improvements in the village planned for the coming year.
So the boaters will just be, in a sense, redirected to another boat launch to complete the washout process, or?
I think we could probably look at some sort of portable solution that we might be able to bring in. It may also be that we can do one side at a time, but it's good food for thought. I'm not sure that I've fully contemplated the implications, but I'll work with the Harbor Master to see if we can find a temporary solution to allow boaters to wash down their boats off after, because obviously that's very important.
Great. Thank you. Appreciate that. Any other comments or questions from commissioners?
I would just like to add the really applaud getting the legislator Assemblymember Bennett support letter. It's great to have their involvement and know what's happening within their district. Also, he's a huge outdoor recreation advocate. So love the engagement. So thank you.
We have so much support from the elected officials, both state and federal, in our region. So we couldn't be more happy to have gotten that letter from Assemblymember Bennett. So thank you.
So having no more questions or comments from the commissioners, I'll ask for a motion to consent.
Motion.
We have a second?
Second.
All in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Motion carries. Thank you. And thank you, Nicole Inglot, for your presentation. So at this time, we will take a break for 15 minutes and we will reconvene at 10:25. Okay, so we'll call the meeting back to order. Back to the agenda, we have Natural Resources Division, Oceanography Programs. This time we'll hear from department staff Hannah Aki on oceanography programs.
Hello, everyone. Can you hear me all right?
Oh, I see. Yes.
Great. So good morning, Chairman and Commissioners. I'm Hannah Ake. I'm the new oceanographer and senior environmental scientist with California State Parks in the Natural Resources Division. And I'll be managing and overseeing California State Parks Oceanography Program. So today I hope to give you kind of a brief intro into the program and discuss some of the great work that we've been up to in the past and what we're hoping to do in the future. Next slide, please.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, please. Hannah, this is Rudy Murillo. You are Ron Flick's successor.
Yes.
Thank you.
So, Ramona did a great job of introducing me at the commission meeting in February. And I thought I would start by kind of giving you a brief intro into my background and what brought me to California State Parks. So as you can see here, I've spent a lot of time on boats, next to boats, under boats throughout my career before joining State Parks. And I've been really lucky to work extensively in California. I've also worked on the East Coast and abroad. And I really hope to bring the best of everything I've learned over the years to the oceanography program here. So prior to joining Parks, I worked in multiple sectors, including the government, academia, and nonprofits. And in each of these roles, I've worked directly with investigators to develop multi-benefit marine research programs. Most recently, as a resource specialist at Metropolitan Water District, I worked to develop programs that evaluated the feasibility and sustainability of alternative water supplies and their ultimate impact on our coast. And, you know, before joining MET, I worked primarily in academia, most recently at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, which is based on the East Coast. And there I worked alongside biologists and oceanographers to compile, describe, and publish oceanographic data from around the world. So really, ultimately, it's a dream come true to be back in California and working to oversee the oceanography program here. Next slide, please. So I think, you know, a few of you may not have received briefings on the program before, so I thought it would be helpful to go into a short history of the program and its scope here. The program began in 1974 with Dr. Richard Seymour serving as the first state oceanographer in California. And Dr. Seymour managed the program until about 1984, when Dr. Reinhard Flick, who I think some of you may know, I know Commissioner Murillo just asked about him, took over and managed the program until about 2020. And so both Dr. Seymour and Dr. Flick did a really tremendous job of managing the program, of developing the program. They grew the program into what it is today. And it's successfully funded research at over 15 California public universities with over 250 peer-reviewed articles published as a direct result of that funding. And so, you know, our programmatic funding has fluctuated slightly from year to year, factoring in recent budget cuts. But currently, the program disperses about $1.4 million annually from the Harbors and Watercraft Revolving Fund. The program also has received a couple of general fund augmentations over the years when appropriated by the legislature. And this actually happened as recently as last year in 2021, which gave the program an additional $1.5 million to disperse to researchers. And so my predecessors really worked hard and were able to allocate some of this funding already in 2021 to bolster deliverables and scopes for a couple of our current projects, but we'll be distributing the rest of that augmentation funding this year for work starting in 2023. And so really that's all to say that overall this program has been able to fund and foster some really, really incredible research that I think has a long-lasting impact on California. I would say the hallmark of this program is really investing in actionable science that can be put to use by the boating community, by conservationists, by managers, amongst many others. And really my aim is to continue to fund actionable research that supports Harbors and Watercraft Revolving Fund goals in general. Next slide, please. So here I have listed all of the projects funded in 2021 with a map on the left showing just some of our current research sites under the program. So all of these projects listed here are generating really incredible deliverables for state parks. And unfortunately, I won't have time to go into detail on all of them today, but I really hope to give you an impression of the work being done by touching on the top two listed here. So you'll notice that a few of these sites are pretty far offshore. These are actually the location of CDIP buoys, which is the first project listed on this slide. And CDIP stands for the Coastal Data Information Program. And what's really incredible is that the Oceanography Program has funded CDIP since 1975. So essentially the program's inception. And the long-term data generated by CDIP is used every single day by Californians. So CDIP's buoys are these really incredible tools located off of our coast, and they collect real-time wave and weather data that help quantify a storm's impacts on California shorelines or potential impacts. And this data is used, you know, in a myriad of ways, from long-term studies to real-time weather apps. I'm not sure if we have any surfers among us, but if you do surf, you might have heard of the site Surfline. And Surfline harvests CDIP data directly. And this site is used by surfers, by fishermen, by boaters, essentially anyone doing anything on the water near our coast. And it's really remarkable to see the flexibility and pervasive use of a long-term data set like CDIPS. And so another group being funded by our oceanography program is the Coastal Processes Group, or CPG. And they're using data collected by CDIPS buoys to analyze long-term impacts and changes to our shorelines. And so this group is developing really, really cool tools for managers, for engineers, for planners. One tool they're working on will help to notify subscribers of incoming storm events and the wave impact of those storms to our harbors and shorelines. They've also developed what they've called a state of the beach report, which summarizes changes over time to state beaches in the San Diego County region every year. And so, you know, that's just two of our projects. We're also funding research on estuaries, coastal erosion, beach infrastructure, you know, long-term physical and ecological factors affecting our coast. Really, there's a lot of exciting work being done in the program and deliverables coming out of the program. Next slide, please. So while I've only been able to touch on a couple of the current projects in detail, I did really want to provide a clear overview of the overall benefits this program gives to DBW and state parks. This program is really pretty remarkable and unique in the sense that we've been funding long-term monitoring of harbors and coasts for decades. And so, you know, unfortunately, long-term monitoring studies are becoming kind of increasingly rare in the scientific research world. And this program alone funds three such long-term studies. And, you know, long-term time series data are really, really invaluable because they help us develop baseline data sets that allow us to analyze change over time. And so we really can only compare the present to the past if we've had the forethought to measure the year before. And so these decadal data sets can be used in a variety of ways. They can analyze beach retreat, measure the effectiveness of infrastructure projects. Really, time series data can be used over and over again by the public, by researchers, by coastal managers. And we probably haven't even really conceived of all of the ways it can be used yet, which makes it really critical for future planning. We're also working to ensure that all the data and deliverables generated by this program are guided by the idea that research should be solution-oriented. We really want to ensure staff and interested professionals statewide can use the tools and findings from this program to inform problem solving in their fields. And so I think this really means making sure that the outcomes of this research are actionable and that ultimately that we're using it to ensure that the public can reap the benefits of all this great work. And so really, I think, you know, overall, this helps us to be more prepared and therefore more resilient at state parks. So research is really at the forefront of planning. And this program provides a mechanism for distilling, you know, cutting edge research from world-renowned universities, world-renowned investigators. I think we really have the best of the best in California, and puts it in the hands of people who need it before they need it. Next slide, please. So we are planning to issue the next call for applications this summer, and these projects will be set to start in January 2023. They're going to be funded by both the Harbors and Watercraft funding we received this year and the remaining 2021 general fund augmentation funding the program received. And so moving forward, really hoping to maintain engagement with both external and internal experts to ensure that we're supporting research that can fill existing knowledge gaps. And so, you know, in the future, we're hoping to engage a group of maybe 5 to 6 external experts on a potentially annual basis to help establish funding priorities and improve deliverables for the following year. And similarly, we want to ensure that we maintain engagement with all of our internal experts. So coastal managers, resource specialists, and foster research projects most suited to their management needs. These are really the folks that know our harbors, our waterways, and recreation areas the best. And so we're hoping to share insight from internal experts directly with our researchers and develop ways for researchers and internal staff to connect frequently and more easily. And so I think this means that, you know, we continue to improve the ways that we disseminate and our research and our deliverables from the program. And this is really to ensure that we continue to align with statewide open data efforts. It's really important to me to make sure that our deliverables are publicly accessible, that they're well described, they're easy to find, and of course, they give proper citations and credits to our researchers. So, you know, I'd like to revamp the program's website to better feature all the great work being funded here. And so finally, you know, last but not least, the program is obviously going to continue to align with all of the statewide strategic goals. I think really there are so many relevant to this program in particular, from the Ocean Protection Council's strategic goals to the upcoming climate assessment to 30 by 30. And really this program can be an incredible tool for helping to implement these strategies and really can fund work directly that will put these strategic goals into action. Next slide, please. So with that, that's the end of my presentation. Thank you all so much for your time. I've included my contact information on this slide, and I would be happy to answer any questions you have. Thank you.
So at this time, I have no public comment cards. Do we have anybody on Zoom?
If any member of the public on Zoom would like to speak on this item, please raise your hand. Chair Ehrman, there is no one on Zoom raising their hand.
Comments or questions from commissioners? Go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hannah, first of all, welcome. I'm really happy that we have somebody with your talent and credentials succeeding Dr. Fleck. I'll go ahead and date myself because I worked with Dick Seymour and Bob Gusa. I don't know if you ever had a chance to meet Dr. Seymour, but he and Dr. Gusa worked very closely on sediment transfer, aerial LIDAR, data retrieval, any number of projects. And Eric Terrell, who's quite a young scientist by my measure, he installed the very first CDEP station on the Imperial Beach Pier, if memory serves. The data that you retrieve and you're able to look at and decipher and turn into these forward-looking solutions is invaluable, as is the CDIP program and others. The state has grown the by far and away the best oceanographic outlook here on the West Coast, and kudos to Woods Hole. They're probably the best oceanographic engineering program ever. I think it would be helpful, especially when our division and this commission is talking about even smaller projects, beach restoration, beach erosion, that on a very regular basis, we contact you as far in advance as possible for some guidance on which direction to go.
Yeah, I would welcome that. And I apologize. I just realized that for some reason, it seems Zoom's telling me I don't have the authority to share my video. Not sure. Oh, there we go. Thank you so much. it might be a problem on my end. So my apologies. But yeah, I welcome that. I would be thrilled to, you know, field those questions and maybe connect you specifically with projects I know that are working in those spaces. I think that would be a great idea.
Mr. Chair, if there's some way to, I don't know if it's necessary, I might ask Catherine to incorporate Hannah's input on beach erosion, beach restoration, whatever, and beyond, because this program is has provided deliverables not only to science and decision makers in the state, lawmakers, so on and so forth, but surfers. Dr. Gusa was a surfer, I think you know Hannah. Maybe he could be seen marching down from his lab and at Scripps Institution of Oceanography past Dr. Revelle's office, which I worked in. We split it up. Kathleen Ritzman had the bigger part of it, to the beach every day to surf. But the surfers can go directly actually to the CDIP website and get the information they need. They don't even need a middle person, I don't think, about the to get a real-time look at the waves. But Mr. Chair, if there's some way to incorporate on a regular basis Hannah's input as the state oceanographer, I think it'd be terrific guidance for us.
I'll make note of that. Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner Murillo. Commissioner Peer, any questions or comments?
I'm just really, again, I'm always seeking to edify myself on these subject matters. I understand there's a proposal now for a large offshore wind generation project in off of the coast of Morro Bay. And does such a project involve your, or does your work involve such a project, or is that under whose auspices is that taking place?
Yeah, so that wouldn't really come, you know, past my desk. My role is more, you know, I think is kind of evaluating, you know, funding projects through the oceanography program that might evaluate the effects of infrastructure projects like that. And so, you know, a project like that specifically wouldn't come through our program here. It would be, you know, our interaction with a project like that would kind of be working with scientists, working with managers to say, you know, what can we learn about the effects of a project like that? And how can we fund research to better understand the effects of a project like that?
So you're on the, what I'm hearing is your Department of Oceanography? How do you say it?
Oceanography. You did fine.
No, it says oceanography here. But anyways.
Oh, Tom, this isn't color, you know.
So you're more on the receiving end of that, all of that information, than pushing forward perhaps to in a public-private partnership.
Direct coordination with a specific project like that.
Yeah, because I just saw one of your buoys looks like it's off Morro Bay, so or data collection centers, I suppose. So that's why I asked the question. But anyways, thank you so much.
Mr. Chair, what, sir. Hi, Anna, it's Rudy again. A very quick question: aerial LIDAR. You know, Dr. Seymour was a pilot.
Yeah, I didn't know that. Wow.
Right. He installed LIDAR in the belly of a plane that Scripps leased to go up and down the coast. Are we using drones now? Or are you still looking?
Yeah, several of our projects are using drones. They're also using, you know, ATVs. So there's more manual measurements as well as drone LIDAR.
And side scan with the
ATV. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
So you're looking at the cliffs as well, obviously.
Yes, cliffs, you know, cliff retreat. You know, one of our researchers, Adam Young, is doing great work tracking cobble berms and cobble movement on cobble berms. So, you know, lots of cool work happening. And if anyone has any specific questions about any projects, I'm happy to connect you with our researchers or answer any questions that, you know, I can answer.
Thank you.
Yeah, Hannah, if you don't mind, the screen went down. I got your number, but what's your email address, if you don't mind?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's just my name, hannah.ake@parks.ca.gov.
Got it. Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you, Hannah Ake, for your presentation.
Yeah, thank you so much. Apologies for the video not working. I'll sort that out.
Oh, there it is, Bing. Thank you.
So our next agenda item, division program reports. We'll now hear from Brian Carroll on law enforcement maritime training.
Good morning, Chair Ehrman, fellow commissioners. My name is Brian Carroll, and I serve as the training coordinator for the Marine Law Enforcement Training Program. The training program provides training statewide to law enforcement officers, harbor patrol officers, lifeguards, and others that work in a marine patrol environment. Statewide training ensures uniform enforcement of boating laws on all of California's waterways, with more than 100 local government agencies providing boating law enforcement in California. The purpose of the training program is to provide comprehensive, current, and effective training courses with reliable consistency. Pictured on this first slide is one of our instructors teaching students how to perform a carriage requirement inspection while conducting a mock enforcement stop during an inland boat operator course held in Sacramento. And a carriage requirement inspection includes checking life jackets, a type 4 throwable, fire extinguisher, and a sound emitting device. Next slide, please. Our training statistics are based on a federal fiscal year, since this is how the division reports statistics back to the United States Coast Guard. So for federal fiscal 21, that would have started October 1, 2020, ending September 30, 21. And during this time, the training program operated with a $438,000 budget. And with that, that funding was received from the United States Coast Guard, Recreational Boating Safety Trust Fund. And with this, we were able to train 339 officers in 28 different classes covering 9 separate disciplines. We did have a decrease in training statistics for fiscal 21. And that was because of COVID-19 related restrictions. 6 classes were ultimately canceled, resulting in approximately 84 officers not receiving training during that time. Pictured on this slide is training vessels transiting through the Port of Los Angeles en route to open water in order to practice underway operations during the Basic Maritime Officers course. And that's hosted by the Maritime Law Enforcement Training Center in Wilmington. Next slide, please. During fiscal 21, the division did maintain COVID-19 safety protocols and secured necessary protective equipment in order to continue provision of maritime training. With that, we were able to train approximately 82% of the average number of officers trained in a fiscal year. The division also expanded the Boating Under the Influence course from 3 days to 4 days. And this is to allow additional practice in administering the standardized field sobriety tests and to incorporate a report writing component into the curriculum. We also increased our instructor cadre by adding 5 new instructors. They joined the Marine Firefighter Operations course and the Rescue Boat Operations course. The division continues to work closely with partnering agencies throughout the state, as well as the Law Enforcement Emergency Services Division within Parks, to maintain a high caliber instructor cadre. Through these partnerships, the division is able to offer the highest quality training possible by utilizing subject matter experts from throughout the state to serve as instructors. Pictured on this slide is the Rescue Boat Operations course. This is hosted by Los Angeles County Lifeguards. This shot was taken in Marina Del Rey, and this particular exercise is simulating underway patient transfer from the Los Angeles County Lifeguard vessel to the United States Coast Guard helicopter. Next slide, please. For fiscal year 2022, the division intends to develop a rescue watercraft course in order to meet the needs of personnel utilizing personal watercraft platforms, and to develop a basic coastal operator course in order to meet the needs of non-sworn personnel working in a coastal maritime environment. And in order to evaluate ongoing training needs, we will continue to meet with partnering agencies by attending the California Boating Safety Officers Association and the California State Sheriff's Association Boating Subcommittee Training Symposiums. Pictured on this slide is the Inland Boat Operator Course held in Sassoon, hosted by the Solano County Sheriffs. And here students are practicing close quarter maneuvering in the Sassoon Sloop. Final slide, please. This slide has my contact information. This does conclude my presentation, and if there's any questions, I can address those at this time.
Public comments, I have Harbor Master John Higgins from the Ventura Park District.
Thank you. I apologize earlier when you introduced us. I regret not welcoming you to Ventura Harbor, and for the commission members who were not present yesterday, anytime you'd like a tour of the facility, feel free to come by, or after, feel free to give me a call and I can walk you through all the things that I kind of went through yesterday. Just real quick,
do we get a free hat?
Yeah. Real quick, I was a beneficiary of training with the Division of Boating Waterways. A little over 20 years ago, I did the 7 courses and was awarded the master's certificate from the Division of Boating Waterways. At that time, that was the only training that was available short of flying to Georgia and spending in excess of a month to do training that is very law enforcement specific. And it's somewhat difficult because this training is put in a box of law enforcement training. But I would say, in all fairness, that to accomplish boating safety, it's much more than a badge and a gun. It is having knowledgeable and dedicated professionals able to transfer their information to the public who more often than not are just completely ignorant of the laws. And so rather than writing a ticket, most of our time spent is educating them of what's really going on and why we're there contacting them. And more often than not, they leave the learning and then transfer that information to others. So 20 years ago, when I participated in the program, it was very inclusive. It was lifeguards, it was firefighters, it was law enforcement, sheriffs, and even private lake patrols. And I think that that is something I'm really excited that you guys are considering incorporating some non-law enforcement training to accomplish some of those ones that are presently being missed. So, for example, I have no problem getting my guys into the Marine firefighting course and the rescue boat handling course, but that critical enforcement one that allows my staff to explain to the people those things that they, you know, just don't know, I was having difficulties getting in because we aren't gun carrying law enforcement. And that is also the case with some of the lifeguard agencies who provide these patrols. So as a commission, you realize all the harbors throughout the state are different, and we rely on kind of force multipliers of utilizing those other agencies to help us. And so the more you can be inclusive in the training moving into the future, I think, you know, you're going to accomplish that higher registration because the staff will know how to explain to people, hey, you know, you need to register your boat because that supports these type of services. It supports education programs, life jacket programs, and then even the boater ID card. That's kind of one of those ones. You have to make contact with that boater to establish that communication and educate them, because often when they're at a place like a launch ramp where there might be a sign, they're so fixated on just getting out of the water. They're so excited on getting out of the water that sometimes they go right past those big obvious signs. And while the marketing is very, I think, savvy, and you guys are utilizing all those great opportunities, social media, signage, pop-ups and stuff, people still are just getting a boat and going on the water. And so we still have a lot of room to improve on that, how to communicate with them. And I think how to really engage them so that they're not leaving a contact disappointed and not transferring the information to someone else, but instead saying, boy, I had a, you know, these guys gave me stickers. They gave me ABCs of boating. They gave me some information on classes to take, and they spread that information to elsewhere. So great job. Brian has been very receptive. We've had conversations back and forth. You guys are definitely on the right track, and I look forward to potentially getting people in those other courses. So thank you.
Thanks for your comments, Harbor, Mr. Higgins. I have no more public comment cards. Do we have anybody on Zoom?
If any member of the public on Zoom would like to make a comment on this item, please raise your hand. Chairman, there are no raised hands.
Commissioner Peer, any comments or questions?
No. Actually, I just wanted to say that during my subcommittee meeting, this program receives such commendation for an efficient use of funding. And so I would just want to, I guess, give my further accolades to staff for developing this program and very efficiently. And it sounds like there's a lot more takers than there are givers in terms of people, agencies that want to take advantage of the program than there are resources to accommodate them, which I view to be a good thing. But I think it's a fantastic program and money well spent. I just wanted to add that comment, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Murillo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't, but I will. We're looking at a bill that said that the language says it's okay for emergency personnel, law enforcement, and lifeguards to exceed 5 miles per hour in performance of duty. Why? How many people do you have in your? And why are you not the equivalent of Schedule C law enforcement?
Well, so one of the deficiencies in California is we have a state fire marshal that kind of looks after firefighting related type stuff. And then we have the California Post, which looks after police and law enforcement, but there isn't someone who has embraced or has committed to looking after water safety and boating safety specifically. So you get a little bit of the Post stepping into boating safety, mostly law enforcement and punitive and trying to establish rules to help enhance the safety. And then on the fire side, they're into the rescue. But so the example that they're trying to correct is that lifeguards are providing rescue to people by way of whatever they can utilize. In the very densely populated Southern California beaches, a typical rescue could pull out 30 to 40 people at one time. Far more than the one lifeguard or the 5 lifeguards in that specific area could deal with. So they use a combination of rescue boats and rescue watercraft, which is also kind of known as a jet ski, to efficiently and as a preventative method, go through those areas and tell those people that they're in a rip current and get them to move. Well, those lifeguard crafts were not included in the wordage or the verbiage because they were not law enforcement craft. The law was designed specifically to address law enforcement crafts, and just unfortunately, the lifeguard crafts weren't part of that. So the amendment is now including lifeguards and fire departments, emergency or tools of the job, to be allowed to do the very same thing that a law enforcement boat would be able to do. Go into an area that otherwise would have a speed restriction to perform their duties, rescue, preventative, and even, you know, enforcement matters, just the same as a law enforcement vessel. So that's kind of what it is. It is being more inclusive.
But during the performance of your duties, you really have no, you're going in there without any defense, right?
Well, no, this was really addressing the Southern California beaches, and the typical one is a rip current. Rip currents are responsible for numerous drownings throughout the year. Lifeguards are very good at identifying them. The public, they typically will get caught off guard. One additional wave is the difference between you having footing on the bottom and not. And then if you're in the wrong spot, some of these really strong rip currents. So the problem was that it was established that those lifeguards could not perform their duties lawfully within that surf area or within the 200 feet of a swimmer or a bather. To rescue somebody, if I needed to rescue you, I can't afford to go less than 5 miles per hour to get to you. I need to go as fast as I can to get to you. And when you're dealing with 40 people or, you know, which Southern California, San Diego, Los Angeles County, you're having multiple crafts. So it was really just addressing a deficiency. It's specific to the coastline. You don't have that same type of challenge, I think, you know, in the lakes. I probably shouldn't say that. I'm not a professional that works on lakes, but I do know that was a big deficiency. And I think it was San Diego lifeguards were the ones that initiated this because of that that wording in the law.
Thank you.
Well, I have to chime in as a 5-year veteran of the city of Newport Beach lifeguards. We never respected a 5 mile per hour speed limit in the surf zone. But I understand that this measure, AB 1682, will remove any kind of liability for lifeguards. But, you know, I worked on the patrol boats for several years, and, you know, this is the last, I'm frankly, this is the first I've ever heard of it, that's a prohibited activity. And I think, as you're saying, it's 200 feet from shoreline is the 5 mile per hour limit. And of course we get right into the surf zone when we were, you know, doing rescues and so forth. But anyways, I just wanted to tell everyone that I was a 5-year veteran of the city of Newport Beach lifeguard
department. And now you're a part of a group that helps support amending this so that they're able to do what they do lawfully. And, you know, if someone challenged them, they say, you know, they don't have to say that.
To a larger point, yeah. I think that there's, but the city of Huntington Beach and the city of Newport Beach berthed their rescue vessels within the harbor. And I've never seen anyone go code 3 out of the harbor. Not that it was ever really necessary, but I could see how this a new statute would help facilitate people getting to where they need to be outside the harbor in a more judicious fashion. Anyways, I've just, like I said, I just wanted to talk about myself for a minute.
Sounds good.
Thanks, John. Any other commission comments or questions? I'll just add to Brian, I like what John was saying, the ability to get this training without having to go to FLETC or wherever you would have to go to in Georgia. I can't imagine the budgeting difference between getting it here in California and having to go back to Georgia to get this kind of training. And I think the demands on law enforcement to be allied assistance, the lifeguards, the harbor patrol, the demand for their service is so high now that this training is just vital to their safety, but also to the performance of their duties. So really applaud the training that they're doing in boating and waterways. It pays dividends for the safety of the people of California.
I concur. Appreciate your comments.
So we thank you, Brian, for your presentation. And next, we have department staff Joanne Andrade for for-hire operator vessel licensing programs and for-hire carrier programs.
Good morning. My name is Joanna Andrade. My presentation will cover the for-hire operator license program and the for-hire vessel carrier insurance verification certificate program. The first program I will update you on today is the for-hire operator licensing program. Pictured here is our proctor, Doug Powell, giving the for-hire examination at the Sac State Aquatic Center. A for-hire license is required by vessel operators who carry more than 3 passengers for compensation in non-navigable waters. Non-navigable waters are those that do not lead to the ocean. Each operator is required to complete an application that is reviewed by the division, If the applicant meets all the requirements, they will be scheduled for a written and practical exam. All exams are conducted by our contractor, Doug Powell, who is a retired lieutenant and holds a 100-ton captain's license with the U.S. Coast Guard. Typical for hire license holders are held by individuals who operate vessels for fishing excursions, summer camps, tours, water taxis, water skiing services, and other related activities. We currently have 322 active for hire vessel operators throughout the state. Pictured here is Doug Powell performing a on-the-water practical exam at Lake Echo. During federal fiscal year 2021, the division issued 80 new licenses. Oh, I apologize. And renewed 39 licenses. During the COVID-19 pandemic, we postponed proctoring exams in the month of March, April, and May. As of June 2020, the division was able to purchase personal protective equipment along with following state and county health department guidelines in order to resume exam proctoring with new safety protocols in place. We continue to proctor exams and practicals statewide. Pictured is a practical exam being administered at Echo Lake near Lake Tahoe. Pursuant to AB 865, which gives DBW the authority to establish a fee for this program in order to become cost neutral, DBW developed a work group consisting of for-hire businesses to help in creating a fee that allows this program to be cost neutral, but also allows the business to not sustain a financial hardship. That's okay, thank you. I will now discuss the For-Hire Vessel Insurance Verification Certificate Program. For-Hire Vessel carriers perform passenger transportation services for compensation, such as fishing charters, sightseeing tours, dinner excursions, and et cetera. The division requires every for-hire vessel and company to procure adequate insurance for protection against liability and payment of damages for personal bodily injuries, including death resulting from those services, and property damages as a result of an accident. Certificates are good for 1 year and all applicants must renew at the time of the insurance expires. We currently charge $25 for new and renewal applications, and we currently have 183 active for hire vessel companies. The division continues to operate under the Public Utilities Commission general orders until the division is able to establish regulations. We continue to work diligently with commercial marine insurance companies to educate them on the for-hire insurance requirements. In addition to provide outreach to the for-hire vessel carrier companies to inform them of the program guidelines and requirements. And that concludes my presentation. Are there any questions?
I have no green comment cards. Do we have anybody on Zoom?
If any member of the public on Zoom would like to speak on this item, please raise your hand. Chairman, there are no raised hands on Zoom.
Commissioner Murillo, any questions or comments? Commissioner Pierre?
None.
Hey, thank you, Joanna Andrade, for your presentation. Excuse me. Next, we have Monique Cabral, Jill Bennett and Michael Beals on yachts and ship broker salesperson's licensing and enforcement programs.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Monique Cabral, and I am the licensing administrator for California Yacht and Ship Brokers. Today, I will be updating you on the broker licensing program. Next slide, please. Yacht brokers are individuals who engage in the selling, purchasing, renting, and price negotiating of used vessels for sale. Next slide, please. The law mandates the Division of Boating and Waterways to license and regulate yacht and ship brokers and salespersons in California. DBW, the division, enforces the activities of licensees to ensure compliance with the Harbors and Navigation Code and the California Code of Regulations, Title 14, Article 8, and to provide consumer protection. Next slide, please. To apply for a California broker's license, an individual must be at least 18 years of age and meet one of the minimum qualifications, which are has been employed at least 1 year within 5 years preceding application as a California licensed salesperson, or has been licensed as a California broker within 5 years preceding the application, or has owned and operated a marine business selling new and used yachts in California for the last three continuous years, or has been employed as a yacht broker or salesperson in another state where that employment was the primary occupation. Most individuals applying for broker licenses in California are California licensed yacht and ship salespeople. Next slide, please. The division issues three types of broker licenses: individuals, partnerships, or corporations. To have a broker's license issued to a corporation, the corporation must be recorded with the California Secretary of State, and the corporation must have a person who qualifies to be the broker of record. Next slide, please. The current fees for a new broker's license is $200 and $25 for the examination. The current fees have been in place since 1990. There are currently 331 active brokers in California. Next slide, please. My supervisor, Joanna Andrade, already actually touched on this. So she pretty much already gave you the information for the AB 865. So I won't repeat that. Next slide, please. And actually, this is my contact information, which can be found on the division's website. And this concludes my presentation. Are there any questions regarding this program?
Okay. Any member of the public on Zoom would like to make a comment, please raise your hand. Chairman, there are no raised hands on Zoom.
Mr. Chair, there's two other presentations on that yacht and ship licensing. Joe Bennett's.
My apologies, I'm getting too anxious.
Hi, my name is Jill Bennett, and I'm the licensing administrator for salespeople for the Yacht and Ship Program. Today, I would like to update you on the status of licensing for salespeople for yachts and ships. For this presentation, a salesperson refers to an individual that works for a licensed yacht broker in California. Brokers must enter into a broker-to-salesperson agreement when bringing any salesperson on board, and the agreement will clearly state the salesperson's commission breakdown and what their expected job duties include. Brokers cannot compensate any individual that is not a licensed salesperson. Next slide, please. To qualify to be a licensed salesperson, applicants must first be sponsored by a licensed California yacht and ship broker. They must be at least 18 years of age, and applicants must clear a background check conducted by the Department of Justice and the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Next slide, please. New salesperson licensing fees total $150. That includes their permanent license, which is valid for 1 year, a temporary license, which is valid for 60 days, and their exam fee. Other fees include licensing renewal fees with a 1 or 2 year option, licensing reinstatement fees with a 1 or 2 year option, $10 licensing transfer fees, which is applicable when a salesperson transfers from one brokerage to another. Next slide, please. Our unit proctors licensing examinations once a month at 3 separate locations within California: Sacramento, San Clemente, and San Diego. Exams have 100 multiple choice questions, and to pass, the applicant must achieve at least a 70% score. The exams include, but are not limited to, the questions regarding licensing, vessel operation and regulation, and the vessel sale process. Next slide, please. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, licensing exams were postponed in January 2021. Since then, we have reinstated exams at all 3 testing sites. License examinations are currently offered following the California Department of Public Health or CDPH guidelines, including thorough sanitation of testing sites before and after examinations and 6-foot social distancing. This slide shows applicants taking the exam at our Sacramento test site with CDPH protocols in place. Next slide, please. We have continued to stay on target with examinations. In 2021, we processed 149 new sales licensing applications and 380 renewal applications. In October of 2021, we successfully moved our offices to our beautiful new state-of-the-art building in downtown Sacramento. Next slide, please. This is my contact information, and this concludes my presentation. Are there any questions?
I have no public question, comment cards.
Any member of the public on Zoom would like to make a comment on this, please raise your hand. Chair Ehrman, there are no raised hands.
No questions on Zoom either.
Okay, I'd like to thank you for listening to my presentation. And now Michael Beals will update you on information from the enforcement unit.
Thank you, Jill. Good morning. My name is Michael Beals. I'm the investigator with the Yacht and Ship Enforcement Program. Next slide, please. So there are 3 main components to the enforcement program. Ensuring regulatory compliance of yacht and ship licensees is the main one. This is mainly done through brokerage inspections, which can be physical inspections of the brokerage, or they can also send in their files for a remote audit. Next one is investigating consumer complaints of yacht and ship licensees. Once the complaint is verified to be within the jurisdiction of the department, so not a new vessel for sale or not a used vessel that's owned by the dealership, the department has a legislative mandate to conduct the investigation. And the third one is monitoring for and responding to unlicensed activity. So checking the various websites like Yacht World, making sure there's no out-of-state brokers advertising boats, there's no unlicensed salesmen, things like that. Next slide, please. So the department enforces the Yacht and Ship Brokers Act through 3 levels of intervention. The levels of intervention depend on various factors. These factors include the type of seriousness of the violation, if it's a repeat offender, the suspected knowledge of the harbors and navigation code, so how much experience they have, et cetera. So the lowest level of intervention is education. Education normally comes in the form of corrective guidance, such as cease and desist orders or warning letters. The assessment of civil penalties is the intermediate level of intervention. These penalties are assessed under the authority of Harbors and Navigation Code Section 739. Penalties can vary from $100 to $1,500 for each separate violation. Typical assessed amount for a first-time penalty is $500 for each separate count. And then the referring a case or penalty matter to the Attorney General's office is the most severe level of intervention. The AG will argue the matter before an administrative law judge. They can assess a higher penalty and they can recoup all costs associated with the case. The AG also has the ability to bring criminal charges, as all codes under this article are classified as misdemeanors by the Harbors and Navigation Code Section 738. Next slide, please. So the following list comes from statistics gathered for the calendar year 2021 and 2022. The 2022 numbers are current through April 18th. So calendar year 21, there was one consumer complaint case open, 35 cease and desist orders issued, 61 physical inspections, and 11 remote audits. Of these, 36 inspections resulted in penalty assessments. The assessments totaled $47,400, all of which was collected. Next slide, please. So again, as of April 2022, there have been no consumer cases pending. There are 23 cease and desist orders have been issued, 16 physical inspections, 2 remote audits. Of that, 10 inspections have resulted in penalty assessments. These assessments totaled $8,000 and $4,750 have been collected. Next slide, please. So that concludes my presentation. Are there any questions?
I have no comment cards, any Zoom?
Any members of the public on Zoom would like to make a comment on this item, please raise your hand. Chairman, there are no raised hands on Zoom.
Commissioner Murillo, any questions? Commissioner Pierre?
Yeah, I'm just not really clear, frankly, what you do. So this is the Yacht and Ship Brokers License Program, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, and so when you say you're investigating people who purport to be licensed brokers or licensed salespeople, is that correct?
Yeah, anyone who has a license is under certain rules and regulations that they have to follow. And so consumers who have a deal will sometimes complain about them. And then it's my job to investigate and see if they violated any part of the Brokers Act.
Any part of the which broker?
The Yacht and Ship Brokers Act.
I didn't hear the last word. I'm sorry.
The Yacht and Ship Brokers Act?
Act. At the Act. Okay. Yeah. So when you say you're doing inspections, what does that mean?
So I go to their brokerages. Every broker in the state is required to have a physical address. I go to their brokerages. I check all their current listings to make sure every listing is required to have certain facts about the vessel. I make sure all those facts are listed. Every contract is required to have certain things like list out how much commission they're going to make. Everything has to have a signed written authorization from the owner's, the vessel owner. So I go through all that paperwork and I make sure that's all there. And then a main thing is they're all required to have a trust or escrow account and to hold all the money in those trust and escrow accounts and distribute. So I make sure all the money was held in those trusts as required.
So I think you said you had 46 complaints statewide, is that right?
Not complaints. In 2021, I had 36 inspections that resulted in penalties for violations found in the inspections. And so far in 2022, I've had 10 inspections result in penalties.
Okay, and so what's the rate of complaints to enforcement activities? I mean, is that 100? You batting 1,000 or what?
So in 2021, I had 72 inspections and 36 resulted in penalties. So about 50%.
Batting 500, that's pretty good. All right, thank you, sir. I just wanted to understand what.
That's what I'm here for, sir.
Absolutely. You do. Great. Thank you.
I just had a quick question. How do you conduct the two remote audits?
So the remote audits is basically, I send them a directive. It's under 735.1 Harbors and Navigation Code, which requires them to keep records for 4 years. I tell them to send me all 4 years of their records and I go through them at home or at the office.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you. Well, thank you, Monique Cabral, Jill Bennett, and Michael Beals for your presentations. This time we'll hear again from Joanne Andrade for Boating Accident Reporting Programs and Law Enforcement Financial Aid Programs.
Good morning. Again, my name is Joanne Andrade, and I administer the Recreational Boating Accident Program and the Boating Safety and Enforcement Financial Aid Program. Today, I'll be leading my presentation with the Recreational Boating Accident Program. The reporting of boating accidents to the U.S. Coast Guard is one of several activities the division must perform in order to receive federal funding for our boating safety programs. The division also uses the data collected by boating accidents to direct the activities such as our education and outreach programs, media campaign, law enforcement, and aquatic center program. Boaters are required to report when a person dies or disappears, when there is an injury sustained beyond first aid, or when there is property damage over 500, or there is a total loss of a vessel. Law enforcement is also required to report if they receive grant funding or respond to a fatality. Accident data received by the division is protected under Section 656 of the Harbors and Navigation Code. Our use of this data is limited to statistical analysis only. The division collects boating accidents in two manners. The public completes the boating accident report form, which we refer to as the BAR, and a portion of this form was seen on the previous slide. Local law enforcement, fire departments, and harbor masters use the boating accident database as seen on this slide. This chart shows a five-year historical accident, injury, and fatality totals collected by DBW. As you can see, accident totals fluctuate from year to year. In 2020, there were 633 accidents, 316 injuries, and 39 fatalities. In 2021, there were 574 accidents, 246 injuries, and 40 fatalities. DBW participates in one of many of the National Association of Boating, of State Boating Law Administrators, referred to as NASBLA, policy committees. This particular committee I participate in is referred to as the Engineering Reporting and Analysis Committee. The committee identifies, evaluates, and analyzes recreational boating data and other related information that can shed light on factors associated with boating accidents and be used to inform the development of state and national level safety policies, program and campaigns, and ultimately be used to measure their effectiveness. Now I'd like to go over the Boating Safety and Enforcement Financial Aid Program. The purpose of this program is to provide local government agencies whose waterways have a high usage by transient boaters and an insufficient tax base to fully support a boating safety and enforcement program. The program is not intended to fully support a participating agency's boating safety and enforcement activities, and agency participation is entirely voluntary. With the state funding from the Harbors and Watercraft Revolving Fund of $11.5 million, the division provides funding to 39 agencies that participate in this program. This is made up of 37 counties and two cities. The program activities include search and rescue operations, including the recovery of drowned bodies, enforcement of state and local laws and regulations, inspections of vessels for compliance, and supervision of organized on-the-water boating activities or water events. The division provided $11.5 million in funding for fiscal year 2021 to the participating agencies. In addition, the participating agencies are required to commit 100% of their vessel county boat taxes. This is made up of approximately $6.9 million. Once counties have expended their boat taxes and the funding from DBW, they operate on their county general fund, which was approximately $13.6 million. The total spent combined between DBW funding and the county funding for this program was over $32 million. As you can see, the agency's need exceeds the program budget amount, and this shows the agency's commitment to the importance of this program. Listed here are a few of the statistics the division collects from the annual activity report, which is required by the participating agencies. These performance statistics help to support the importance and impact of the program and the need for local governmental agencies on our waterways. The division partners with various statewide programs that promote boating safety and education. Listed here are a few of those partners, and we are grateful for each and every partner that we are working with. Operation Drywater is a year-round boating under the influence awareness and enforcement campaign. Operation Drywater Heightened Awareness and Enforcement 3-Day Weekend takes place annually around July 4th. It's a nationwide awareness. Counties throughout California register to participate. Local law enforcement, including California State Parks, participated in the 2021 nationwide 3-Day Heightened Awareness Campaign.
I'm happy to announce that San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department received the NASPLA 2021 Operation Drywater National Award for Small Category Top Agency Award. Over the course of the three-day heightened enforcement weekend, the San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department deployed three officers and made 17 boating under the influence arrests. Operation Drywater is now open for registration this year, which will be conducted from July 2nd through July 4th. And for more information, you can visit the NASPLA Operation Drywater homepage. And that concludes my presentation. Are there any questions?
I have no public comment cards. Anybody on Zoom?
If any member of the public on Zoom would like to comment on this item, please raise your hand. Chairman, there are no raised hands.
Commissioner Pierre, question or comments?
I'm curious, the dry boater program. So there's some statutory framework that would be equivalent to the motor vehicle code for getting a DUI on a boat. Is that, it's not under, I would presume it's not under the motor vehicle code. Or is it? I mean, I don't know.
So for referring to if there was any like a sort authority that they would cite that individual for boating under
that's
the influence.
What I'm asking,
correct.
Yeah.
Okay. So I would want to research that specifically, but I believe it's going to be in the bill authority schedule that would actually list fines for that. And that also would reference the citation authority that law enforcement has to cite someone for boating under the influence. The bail and, schedule, my apologies.
And, but that would not be under, if I was say on the San Francisco Bay or Los Angeles Bay or Newport Harbor, what's the, I don't understand what the jurisdictional reach of a state statute would be. You know, you see, for example, in San Francisco, you see there's, you got these guys out there by, what do you call the ballpark, right? There's a bunch of, well, I shouldn't say drunk people. There are people who are enjoying themselves. And so San Francisco is going around, I guess, citing them. I don't have any idea how that works. So that's, I guess that's a comment, but a question also is sort of who really has authority to do these kinds of enforcement activities.
Yeah. So my understanding within this would be that state has authority from shore up to 3 miles, nautical or 3 miles from shore. And then after that, it turns over to the U.S. Coast Guard.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Commissioner Murillo. All right. Thank you, Joanna Andrade, for your presentation. So now we'll move on to public comment period for items not on the agenda. Do you have any blue comment cards, Megan? We have anybody on Zoom?
Yes, we have two speakers so far. If anyone else would like to speak on Zoom, please raise your hand. The first commenter up will be Jerry Desmond. Jerry Desmond, please unmute your mic.
Thank you. Commissioners, Jerry Desmond with Recreational Boaters of California, RBOC. A couple of comments. First is our group is a very active participant in each of the subcommittees that were discussed earlier. And we certainly appreciate and concur in the progress and the dedicated effort that's being made, both by the you members of the commission and also the Division of Boating and Waterways led by Ramona and the staff that are engaging helpfully in this that process, as well as performing all the services and functions that they do and they're reporting on today. Also concur in the interest in the registration numbers being as low as reported and as it's being reviewed, especially as boat sales have picked up during the pandemic. We concur in the interest there, and we also concur in the interest in boaters complying with the requirements of the boat operator certification card. When all the groups and the legislature came together to establish that program, the parameters, we really desired that there be compliance. And so we look forward to efforts there before we have some kind of major problem based on non-compliance.
in that stakeholder process. We're quite encouraged and quite appreciative. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Desmond.
The next speaker will be Andrea Luker. Andrea Luker, please unmute your microphone.
Good morning. This is Andrea Luker. I'm the president of the California Association of Harbor Masters and Port Captains. Our association is going on our 75th year. Today, I just want to thank the Division of Boating and Waterways staff and Director Quintero on their recent participation in the California Boating Congress in mid-April in Sacramento. The California Boating Congress, as you well know, is an opportunity for the marine industry and boating community to come to Sacramento and to advocate on issues of importance. There was a great turnout this year, and the attending organizations and individuals seem to have a general consensus on many of the issues and I think a great willingness to work together. In closing, thank you again for your participation in the Boating Congress and in as well as just know that many of our members in our association have been the recipients of grants and loans for critical equipment and infrastructure from DBW, and we're most appreciative of those opportunities. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrew Luker.
Chairman, there are no more speakers on Zoom.
So at this time, I'll formally close the public comments for non-agenda items. Our next agenda item is any administrative items. I have none. We'll move on to suggested agenda items for our next meeting. Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Chair, I don't know. Mr. Desmond, are you still on online or on Zoom? Or?
Yes, sir. I am here.
Oh, I would love to know when people ask us, you know, what is Boating and Waterways Commission, or you know, why is boating and waterways important? I would love to be able to complete the sentence, you know, well, the economic impact of recreational boating in California is blank, dollar sign, whatever. I can't imagine how many numbers. Do we guess at this, or is there anything? Is there any foundational?
Yes, Commissioner, there is. There is a wonderful one pager that is developed by NMMA, the National Marine Manufacturers Association, and I'm trying to remember. I think we have used that in the Boating Congress that Andrea talked about earlier. Off the top of my head, I don't have it in front of me. It's around $16 billion in an annual economic impact. But there is that kind of document, and I'm sure we'll get it to you and the chair and the division as well, because it is important. And it reiterates one of the discussions in the subcommittees is the interest in having the DBW's economic impact report, that I think everybody in the subcommittee process is encouraging to be reactivated with the expenditure of the appropriate dollars so that there is information specifically developed by DBW that would be quite helpful in that regard too.
I think that would be great, Mr. Chairman, if you agree that we can try to get our fingers around it.
I'll make notes. Any other suggested agenda items for our next meeting?
Well, if I may, Mr. Chair, it is more of an administrative issue, but if maybe we could get some guidance on this subcommittee process and, you know, like whatever formal, for lack of a better word, recommendations or consensus, and when we would be reporting that to the full commission. Because I feel that we're kind of wrapping up maybe one or two more meetings on a monthly basis. You know, we could probably have a report by the next full commission meeting of recommendations. But so anyways, I would appreciate guidance in that regard as to sort of setting some timelines on trying to kind of wrap up that process.
We'll ask for what the deliverables should be like. Is that what we're asking for?
So I'll kind of answer that. Yeah, so the division is working on a timeline document. So we'll be able to share that shortly.
Okay, so we'll just look for that moving forward.
Yes.
Great, thank you.
Any other agenda items? Hearing no more agenda items, we will move to adjourn today's commission meeting, and we thank you all for being here and your participation.